having a great time in the book of James. And I tell you, the more that I spend time in James, and I'm studying with a little bit of a deeper level than I normally do when I'm just reading through. I'm having a good time. I'm getting some good stuff out of this. I hope that you are as well. And this evening, we're going to be taking a look at a lot of different areas. Well, generally three basic areas. See, James brings us again face to face with the ugly parts of our nature, right? And all of the challenges that we need to overcome in this walk of faith. Now, in this chapter, we're going to learn that walking in faith requires a believer to submit to God despite the pull of our own warped desires that are stimulated by the flesh and by the world and by the devil. This is stuff we all deal with. I don't care what level you are in your faith, we're all dealing with those three things: our flesh, the world, and the devil. So we also seem intent on taking God's place as a judge rather than accept our rightful place as a mere citizen of his kingdom. We're going to look at that later on in this chapter in verses 11 and 12. And then finally, James exhorts us to resist the temptation to distort reality and to view the future as though we were certain of being a part of it and that we are in control of it. All of those things we're going to look at tonight. We have to recognize and we have to accept the fact that we are totally subject to God's will, and it's only by his will that we live and die, that we prosper or struggle. It's God's will that really comes into play here. And your will is a part of how that all turns out as well, to a certain degree. We'll kind of cover that a little bit. But let's get into the first part of this, where James warns us about pride. Here in verses 1 through 4, or actually 1 through 3, we're going to read through this just to get us started. It says, "Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and you do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and you do not receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures." See, James is like a bulldog here on this pride thing. I mean, he just will not let go of it. All through the book of James, he's really dealing with it. He's always pointing out about how the struggles that Christians have are essentially rooted in selfish pride. Do you have problems controlling your tongue, like it talks about in chapter 3 that Michelle taught us about last time? Well, pride is to blame. Do you have prejudices that affect how you treat other people, as we studied in chapter 2 when I taught the last time in this past couple of weeks? Well, if that's the case, pride is to blame again. And here in chapter 4, are you in conflict? Are you fighting with those around you? Are you having the fights and the wars that go on? Well, pride is to blame in this case too. Pride. So we go and we look at this, and he says, do they come, the fights and the wars that he's talking about in verse 1, do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? That word translated desires is really literally means pleasures or passions. So that's what it is that is bringing this about. The picture that he's painting here is one of the flesh demanding satisfaction. I don't know about you, but my flesh wants to be satisfied. Well, actually, I do know about you. Your flesh wants to be satisfied as well. How well it can accomplish that has a lot to do with how you respond to it. Our flesh just wants to be satisfied. It is always demanding satisfaction, and it will continue to demand it, even at the cost of wars, even at the cost of internal conflict and external conflict in your life. The desires of the flesh are so strong that people are willing to quarrel and fight in order to satisfy those fleshly desires, that passion within us. And of course, that always leads to sin. Then we look at verse 3, and he says, "You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss." It's kind of like there's this slightly different approach. We've thought about it. We get all excited, and we argue with other people trying to get our own desires, our own flesh satisfied. But then what about if we took a spiritual approach? Right? What if we just ask God to satisfy our desires, our passions? That word, by the way, for desire is the Greek word hedonon. And what if we ask God to satisfy that? God is not, you know, obliged to answer our every prayer with a yes. He's not going to act in ways that are contrary to His will, even if we continue to bombard Him with fervent prayer. That's not the way it works. When we seek to further our hedonon, our own passion, our own desire, our own fleshly desires, well, then we're asking amiss. And that's why you're not seeing that satisfaction. That's why you are struggling. See, God doesn't work the way that we would prefer on many occasions, where we just ask and He gives. God, you're a good God. I know you want me to be happy. Give me what I need. Give me what I know I want. Well, if what you want is not God's will, He is not going to relent. As James points out, when we're praying in that way, our motive is not to please God, it's merely to satisfy our own desires. Not good. Not good. Well, let's move on. I've determined in my heart I'm going to make this a shorter night. So let's move on to James 4:4, where it says, after you know you've been amiss and you want to spend all of what God would have for you on your own pleasures, verse 4. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Friendship with the world. Think about that for a moment. Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Now, when we're kind of going through this study, we're talking about all kinds of different concepts, and as Pastor Ben and I think Michelle probably alluded to this too, we want to pick out words that seem to have an importance and really kind of dig into them. And so what is this thing that it's talking about when it says the world? Well, it's a phrase that we use or a term that we use quite often in the Christian world, right? We talk about those in the world. You don't want to be of the world because that's not where God is. You don't. What is the world? Well, the world is not the eretz. That's the Hebrew word for the earth. You know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the eretz is that word. It's not the earth. It's the cosmos. That's the Greek word that is used here for the world. Cosmos is friendship with the world. This cosmos is the way of the world. So it's talking about a system, a world system. That's what it's referring to. Not just everybody outside the church. It's just speaking of this world system, a complex interweaving of sinful desires that shapes the society of lost humanity. Obviously, we see it everywhere if you're at all in tune with God and His Spirit. But it wasn't always like that. You know, in the beginning, there was no cosmos. Right? No world system. There was the earth, and there was man, and there was man's relationship with God. That's the way it was. And actually, that was a pretty good system, right? God walked with Adam in the garden, That was the system that God instituted. But when Adam transgressed, things changed. Things changed dramatically, and there was a system that began to develop, and very swiftly it developed. It started in the heart of man, and it infects all of social and political and economic systems the world over. The cosmos, the world at its core, is rebellion to God. See, it is the result of the fall. It's the world system, and it's in rebellion to God. It's anti-Christ in its influence. It's a bad deal. So, you know, don't take it lightly when we talk about the world. It's very important that we understand the seriousness of this. And it's obvious that it's anti-Christ because none of the world's systems help people find Jesus. So if you're not helping people find Jesus, then you are steering them away, and that would be an anti-Christ kind of thing to do. You are against Jesus. In fact, the world system seeks to displace God and certainly at least ignore Jesus, right? In fact, within the world system, there sometimes is a little bit of room for God. You even hear some worldly people talk about God, but you rarely hear them talk about Jesus. Jesus is the taboo. In the world, sin is considered acceptable. It's pleasurable. And when you're friends with the world, you will lose your awareness of sin and the reality of its effects. When you, as he's talking about here, those pleasures, those desires, that passion, when you surrender to the flesh, the hedonon passions, then we choose to become friends of the world, of the world system, of a system that is spiritually unfaithful to God, a system that is flat out opposed to Jesus and the gospel. So now, as we sit here and I'm talking, you go, well, this is a pretty easy choice to make. I either be friends with the world or friends with God. Yes, it's an easy choice to make, but somehow we keep slipping. We keep sliding a little bit here and there. You are influenced by the world around you, and that's why we need to be very much aware of what this is all about. The difference between the world, the cosmos that it's talking about here in James, the difference between the world and God is so vast that if we move toward the world, we just automatically are moving away from God. We alienate ourselves from God when we move farther and closer to the world. And when I'm talking about moving toward the world, becoming friends with the world, we're not talking about the occasional sin. All right, don't misunderstand. He's not talking about occasional sin because, come on, all of us have sinned, and we do sin. He's not speaking about that. Oh, you sinned, you friend of the world. No, we all sin. He's not talking about that. He's talking about an attitude of the heart that leads a person to turn themselves away from God and to begin walking toward the world. In other words, begin satisfying the flesh, satisfying our own personal desires, our own personal gain. Rather than knowing sin by observation or personal experience, as Christians, we should be able, with our God-given minds, to discern good from evil. And that's becoming more and more rare, being able to clearly discern good from evil. We'll talk more about that as we get closer to the end of James. Now, other translations here, and if we look at verse 5, talking about being an enemy of God, if you are friends with the world. It goes on in verse 5. Or do you think that the scripture says in vain, the spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously? Other translations have it slightly different. I like the English Standard Version, how it puts it. It says, he yearns, God, talking about God, he yearns jealously over the spirit that he has made to dwell in us. Exodus 25 says that God is a jealous God. God is a jealous God. He is jealous for his spirit that he put in you, for the spirit that he created in you. He jealously yearns over the spirit that he has made to dwell in us. You can see other references to God's jealousy in Exodus 34, 14, and Psalm 78, 58, Psalm 79, 5. There's just a number of verses that talk about how God can be jealous. And keep in mind, you know, it's this friendship of the world that we begin to flirt with that makes God jealous. It naturally is going to provoke the jealousy of God when we start cozying up to the world. And his current concern, when we're talking about God being jealous, you might think, well, I don't know that jealousy is really a good characteristic for anybody, including God. Well, understand, his concern for us is what provokes that jealousy in him. It's his concern for, it's not some unmet emotional need that God has that he is all worked up about. No, it's because he is concerned for us. It's a jealousy of us for us. And how about his response? Right here it says in 5, he is jealous, but in verse 6, how does he respond? But he gives more grace. He doesn't just hammer us because we've got out in line. No, he gives us more grace. It says, but he gives more grace. Therefore, he said, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And here James is quoting from Proverbs chapter 3, verse 34. He gives us more grace. He gives us more grace. The suggestion here is that those who submit to divine wisdom will receive the necessary grace from God to put into practice the kind of life that James talked about in chapter 3 when we looked at verses 13 through 18. It's a pretty high standard to live up to, but there is grace for us when we humble ourselves before God, when we turn to Him. On the other hand, those who want to elevate themselves and their priorities and their flesh, they will be humbled. God resists the proud, it says, but he'll give grace to the humble. God will fight against the plans of the proud. He will, because their plans are not on his side. Not only that, they're not good for you. Not good for you. So we want to exist within his grace. We want to receive that grace. Verse 7. I told you I was going to kind of move through this rather quickly. Verse 7. Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. This is, you know, one of the things I have found out about James as we're going through it. There are an awful lot of scriptures in James that we kind of quote. You know, we remember what he's saying. I can't tell you how many times I have told people that very same thing. Submit to God, resist the devil, and he'll flee from you. Now, you know, Michelle did a great job of talking about the other languages and showing you the words. And I, you know, she's kind of looked at the Hebrew, and we kind of all have looked at the Greek. I went to the Latin to see if I could get a better understanding of what this particular verse says. And I went to a very old Latin dialect. And here's what it says in Latin. Erfor they absmit se ute adge. I just wanted you to know that I can get into the other languages too. Pig Latin is the only Latin I know, but... And even then I struggled. Did you notice I struggled with that? It's not my native language. No, it simply means submit to God, just like you would think it means. Submit to God and resist the devil, and he will flee from you. The best thing we can do is to submit to God. We need to follow, not just submitting to God, but also the other part, right? Submit to God. How do we do that? We abandon our own selfish pride, like we were talking about all through verses 1 through 6. And then we have to resist any temptation that the devil throws our way. Resist it. And here's the good news. You can do it. You can do it. But Pastor, it's so hard. You know, the thing I want to do, I don't do. And the thing I should do, all of that, I'm telling you, you can do it. No matter how powerful the devil may be, if we set ourselves against him, we will prevail. We will prevail. You know, one of the greatest New Testament examples of this is that story about the Gadarene demoniac. I always think about that when I think about resisting the devil, when I think about the fact that some people feel like they are just trapped and they can't seem to break free from whatever it is that the devil has helped them to fall into. Well, think about this guy that's out in the tombs and he's cutting himself and nobody can seem to control him, and he breaks chains and he's just all full of demon spirits. But yet when he sees Jesus, think about this, he sees Jesus and he is able to run up to him and fall down at his feet and worship him. This is a guy full of a legion of demons who is able to go to Jesus and worship him. Now, it wasn't the spirit of those demons that drove him to worship Jesus. It was his spirit, his desire, his will. He had that much power that he could overcome what the devil would do in him, what those demons were able to do as controlling him when he wanted to go to Jesus. You read about that in Mark chapter 5. Don't talk about how hard it is. You can resist if you want to. Ooh, that can kind of, that puts a bag on me. You can resist if you want to. Of course, if you still want to pursue your fleshly desires, well, you will. You will. But I think we should be submitting to God and resisting the devil. Verse 8, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Here's more good news. God will draw near to those who come to him. God will draw near to those who come. How do you draw near to God? Well, it tells you right here. We just read it. Cleanse your hands. Purify your heart. Doing exactly opposite of the flesh, right? And it talks about how you need to do this. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. The double-minded are those who are divided in their hearts between loving God and loving the world. Those who are divided between satisfying the flesh and serving the Lord. We need to do what it says. Draw near to God. He will draw near to us. Verse 10. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. Humble yourself. That means cast off that pride. You know, what James is continually harping on, I just say it's harping, but it's good for us. That pride, we've got to deal with pride. And if we look at verses 10 or 7 through 10, there are actually really 10 commands in these small three verses that we see here. And see if you can see these words in those verses, 7 through 10. It says submit. It says resist. It says we should draw near. We cleanse. We purify. We lament. We mourn. We weep. It's not all happy. We weep, we turn, and we humble ourselves. Together, you put all of that together, that portrays a complete reversal of the attitudes that shape the spiritually immature and the unfaithful. Oh, you know, I think just reading through James, there is so much that he is prodding us to do. James is a book of doing, right? We talked about, well, faith is not of works. It's of faith. I mean, salvation is not of works, it's of faith. But there's a whole lot of doing that goes into that faith side, right? James continually brings us to the point of, okay, now what are you going to do? Let me tell you what you should do. Let me tell you what you shouldn't do. Don't do that. But here's what we need to be doing. We need to take all of this seriously. So then we move on into the next kind of category here where he starts warning us against judging others. So let's read. Verse 11. Do not speak evil of one another, brethren. He who speaks evil of a brother and judges his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. Who are you to judge another? Matthew 7:1, it says, judge not. Judge not that you be not judged. Don't be judging others. God is the ultimate judge. We just have to come to that conclusion. He is the one who will judge all, for good or bad. He is the judge. Now, we have to remember that our role is keeping the law, not exalting ourselves above the law, not exalting ourselves even as an interpreter or an applier of the law. It's God's law. He is the judge. And, you know, we kind of get into there is, in fact, let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6, starting in verse 2. It talks about us judging. It says, do you not know that the saints will judge the world? Oh, wait, James just said, don't judge. Do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? Do you not know that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life? If then you have judgments concerning things pertaining to this life, do you appoint those who are least esteemed by the church to judge? I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you, not even one who will be able to judge between his brethren? We need to understand the difference here in what James is talking about in judging and what Paul in Corinthians is talking about when he says we are to judge. If you kind of read through this passage, you'll notice that it's talking about, like in the end of verse 2, judge the smallest matters. So it's talking about us judging matters. It talks about us judging things of this life. It talks about us judging disputes among the brethren. When 1 Corinthians says that we are to judge, it's not talking about the personal, often vindictive critical judging of our brothers and our sisters. So we have to be careful. It's very easy to allow a spirit of criticism just kind of overrun in your life, where everything you see and everybody that you know is just not quite living up to the standard that you think the law, God's rules, should hold them to. Well, know this, you are not their judge. We are not to judge one another. We are to judge. Now, I didn't find this. Remember that guy I told you about the last time I was talking in James 3? About the guy in Missouri that I was wondering if he was watching, because I know he watches our services. He sent me something the other day. And I have a picture to show you. Take a look at this. This is a spiritual matter. This is a nativity set that he found being sold on Amazon. Now, I have no problem judging this. It's like, there is so much wrong with this. I'm just telling you, this is wrong. This is just wrong. There is so much wrong with this. I can't even take the time to go through all that there is that is wrong with this. And my first reaction to this was, what kind of idiot would put that up there? What kind of kook would make this nativity set? Now, I can judge that as being, that's wrong. I need to be careful about what I say about the people. Maybe there was a Christian that had good intent here, and maybe they're just a little misguided. I mean, you know, I can't imagine why baby Jesus would have to have a mask on. Or anybody else in that picture. You know, you could take this down many different roads. I'm having a hard time not going there too. But this is an example of where we need to judge matters, not necessarily condemn the people. You understand the difference? And James is telling us not to judge. You can take that down, please. James is telling us not to judge. Now, I guess I should say, if you bought one of those, no judgment on you. If you actually have one of those in your home, well, just, you know, I'm not against you, but that whole concept was, anyway, moving along, we want to be careful about how we judge, what we judge. There is a place for judging. You know, you do need to be able to judge right from wrong. You do need to be able to judge circumstances. You do need to be able to make, we all make judgments. And that's a necessary part of living, particularly in the world when we talk about what's right and what's wrong. You need to be able to make those judgments. And you can't do it if you don't know the word. We're going to get into more of that. Let's move on, get you out of here early enough that you can spend a little time fellowshipping. Verse 13, another new section here, boasting. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there and buy and sell and make a profit. Back in these days, it was not uncommon for people to go on business trips, to go and sell their wares and to be involved in some sort of commerce, finance, going in other ways, and they would make their plans, and that's what he's talking about here, that you'd spend a year there, buy and sell, make a profit. Verse 14, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. The problem here, what James is trying to bring about, the problem is not the plan that this person may have had. It's not the concept of making money, you know, oh, well, you shouldn't go and do that. No, he's not talking about that. James is objecting to an attitude toward the future that takes no account of God. You know, we can be a rather arrogant species. In spite of our frailty and our ignorance of tomorrow, We think that we can navigate this life all on our own. That's not what, instead of presuming to plan our lives around our ambitions, right, around our desires, we need to humbly seek after the life that God would have for us. And that's what James is getting about. You boast about all that you're going to do. You have all of these plans. You don't even have a concept of reality. James really confronts us with that reality, the stark reality of what is your life? What is it? The what's translated here as vapor is the Greek word atmos. And it can be translated as smoke or steam, incense in places. It's all instances that refer to something that is transient, something that is gone in a moment. And James wants you to understand there is a contrast, a comparison to be made between an eternity that you will live, your spirit will go on for eternity. This life is just a moment. Our earthly lives are just a little wisp in comparison to eternity. And we can get caught up, so much caught up in the here and the now and the challenges and the struggles that we are facing every day. Even in the triumphs and the victories, we get so caught up in that we lose sight of eternity. We focus on, again, our own selves, our own desires, trying to accomplish what we want to accomplish, do what we want to do, and oftentimes we forget about eternity. We forget about the plan of God and His desire for us. And James wants to shake us out of our apathy, wants us to reassess our priorities in the light of eternity. Our life really is just in comparison. And you know, the amazing thing I think about us as human beings, that so many of us are still alive. Think of all the challenges that we've come through and diseases and all kinds of other things. You know, I was thinking about Sarah, and you know, Sarah had a great challenge to her life. She really would have died had she not gotten all the good care that she had gotten. But there's kind of a little story, I'm not sure that many people know this. So Sarah was in this really terrible accident and had to be life-flighted, you know, to the hospital. And there was, you know, she laid in the hospital for several days before they could even do the surgeries that were needed to put metal in her arm to correct all the broken bones there and the big metal rod in her leg. And then as that got done and she started to recover a little bit and she went on to rehab. And in rehab, they discovered, uh-oh, there's another problem here. She's not overcoming like she should be at this stage of the game, and they discovered that there were some perforations in her intestines caused by the seatbelt. You know, seatbelt saved their lives, but it also can cause injury with that kind of great force and trauma. And so what they had to do was take her into surgery, and this is the ugly nitty-gritty part. Don't listen. She'll tell you know, this surgery involves them opening her up, you know, and taking all of her intestines out, laying them on a table, and then inch by inch going through that whole pile of intestines to find any kind of little holes or perforations. And they found some, and they took some out, and then she's back in recovery and doing well. And that's how she can survive all of that. But here's the thing I want you to realize, or this little story that came to my mind. She's in the hospital after that surgery, and she can't eat anything. They've got this tube down her nose going into her stomach to drain things out. It's really ugly. It's really gross. She just... But hey, she's alive. But in that time, she couldn't eat anything, but she could suck on hard candy. And one day that she was sucking on hard candy, a little something that they gave her, I don't know if it was a mint or butterscotch, something. Anyway, she's sucking on that hard candy in the hospital. She can't move. She's just kind of pretty much immobilized. And then all of a sudden she starts to choke on this hard candy. And the thought went through her mind, I made it through all of these surgeries and all of that, and I'm going to die here sucking on a piece of candy. And it was possible she could have, but she somehow got it cleared out before she expired. But that's just how frail our lives are here on this earth. You know, you might have all kinds of great plans. You might think things are going to go a whole different way than what actually ends up happening. And James is trying to help us understand that. Instead of making all of our plans, instead of doing all that we desire, instead of ignoring the realities of what this life is all about and losing sight of eternity and what we should be doing, he says, instead, verse 15, instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. If the Lord wills. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Now when he says we should say instead, if the Lord wills, we shall. This is not a fatalistic resignation to a life in which you have no control. Right? Well, it doesn't matter really what I do because God's going to do what God's going to do, and whatever happens is going to happen. And no. Our behavior and our actions should consistently demonstrate our dependence on the Lord. That's what he's trying to help us understand. Our dependence on the Lord, and not just like, oh, we're so dependent we can't move if God doesn't, you know, carry us along. No, our dependence on understanding what his will is, our dependence on knowing if we follow his will, it's going to be good. And if we do, it will matter in eternity, rather than just wasting your life in this little wisp of a moment that you have here on earth as this life. You know, in our life, we have our plans, but, you know, God may determine that at the present time that patience through tribulation is a greater need for us than attaining our goals. Don't be so arrogant in your plans, in your thoughts. All right, let's finish this up. One last verse. Oh, I'm not getting you out of here that early. Sorry. James 4:17. Therefore, all of this, therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. James summarizes with his point, the point that he's been making throughout all of this epistle. It is sin to doubt whether an action is right and then still go ahead with it. It's also sin to know what is right and then not do it. I mean, it kind of seems like an off-the-cuff statement when you're kind of reading along and all of, and then he just ends, therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. Well, it does fit in this conversation. James is merely continuing to make that point, the point that he's been harping on through this entire epistle. You see, we let our pride sometimes obscure what is good. You're right? What is good? Who is my neighbor? In our pride, we can kind of twist all of that around and come to the point where we don't even do what we know we should do. In the end, it's all about humble living. Really, it's all about humble living, that we've got to be humble enough to submit to God's purpose and to be doers of his purpose for us. Father, I thank you that you are continuing to bring new life and new truth to us reviving our spirits, igniting within us a greater desire to follow after you. And Lord, I pray that each of us here will continue to think these things over, to rethink our own lives in relation to what we are learning through the book of James. Lord, I pray that as we continue to live day to day, that we see the examples that James uses pop up in our own lives, and then with wisdom and with your guidance and by the Spirit's prompting, we can react rightly and we can relate properly to you and also reject the world. Lord, help us to be wise stewards of the Spirit that you have placed in us. Help us to be wise stewards of the time that we have, this little wisp that we have on this earth, that we might fulfill our purpose and glorify Jesus. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Amen. Well, one more chapter. The big guy, batting cleanup next week. Is that a right baseball term? Okay. You know, I'm not a big sports fan, so I could get it wrong. All right, well, God bless you. If you need prayer, if you have a desire to have somebody join with you in faith, we have faith people here. We'll be happy to pray for you. Otherwise, you are dismissed, and you do have a little bit of time, fellowship a little bit, especially with those that you don't know. Now is a good time to say, hey, you know, I see you.